if you have comparable providers that are very skilled with their tool, are trained to use that tool, have a nuanced approach to assessment, and a plan for aftercare, I'm happy.
Welcome to FemPower Health. This is Georgie. In today's episode, we delve deep into the nuanced and often controversial world of tongue ties in infants, a topic that has sparked debates among healthcare professionals and concerned parents alike. Joining me are Victoria Ficelli, author of Feed the Baby and a dedicated lactation consultant, alongside Dr. Shayna Holman, a forward-thinking dentist with a PhD in infant psychophysiology. Both experts come together to shed light on the complexities of diagnosing and treating tongue ties, aiming to demystify the procedure and address common misconceptions. Our discussion is inspired by recent coverage in the New York Times and aims to provide a balanced perspective, highlighting the importance of cross-functional care and ethical practice in the treatment of tongue ties. Whether you're a new parent navigating feeding difficulties or a healthcare professional seeking insights into best practices, this conversation is a must-listen for anyone looking to understand the intricacies of tongue tie treatment from the experts themselves. So by way of background, just to introduce how this episode came about, is in December, there were a couple of New York Times articles and opinions written about tongue tie for babies when it comes to moms who are struggling to breastfeed. And I have an expert that I know, and I was like, I need to talk to someone. I want to hear expert reactions to this. I want to have a two-way conversation. I don't want it to be just something I read in the New York Times. And it was really interesting because some experts were hesitant to go on a podcast to speak publicly. So I'm really intrigued to have this conversation. And so welcome, Victoria and Dr. Holman. So why don't we start by first introducing yourselves, and then we will dive into nursing, tongue tie, and any nuance that comes up in this conversation that people need to be aware about. So Victoria, do you want to go first?
So I'm Victoria Ficelli. I'm an IBCLC. I wrote a book about feeding babies called Feed the Baby. And I was an IBCLC and honestly a little bit of a tongue tie skeptic. I was sort of brought up in my program, very sort of like published research driven. It was a program within a school of public health. So really grounded in that perspective, really focused on like positioning for babies and kind of looking at the whole picture. And I came up kind of in between two waves of pain in breastfeeding. There was one wave of thinking everybody had thrush, so a yeast infection on their nipples, into thinking everyone had tongue ties. So I started as a little bit of a skeptic, finished up school in lots of different settings, went out into the community and became an outpatient lactation consultant. So I was working with folks in their first weeks and months home. And I would, there were some babies that no matter what I did, the realities of a tie were just there. And so I would then refer to ENTs or dentists to correct the tongue ties, sometimes midwives. And I was shadowing everyone to these different places. And it just, like, they needed this care and it was better after, but I just didn't love the way it was happening. Like the care directly to the parents just wasn't where I needed it to be. And then the other piece of this work that I was seeing that was so important was really looking at the baby, really looking at like, is this, like I'm looking at, could this be a different low supply issue? Could this be thrush? Could this be a positioning thing? But I also needed someone really looking at that baby, looking at patterns of tension, doing that. So I was working with a body worker, but I just didn't feel like I had deep trust in the providers that were actually doing the procedure. And so I sort of like made it my mission to find somebody who would work in tandem with different providers, but also who I could really trust. And so I ended up just in a random Facebook group and saw this dentist. And I was like, well, at least you're a woman. Like, let's just start there. And so Dr. Holman was just starting her practice and I marched in there and I was like, look, here's the thing. There's these tongue ties. I really like need someone with ethics to do this. And Dr. Holman was like, Oh, yeah. I do those when I volunteer in nursing homes sometimes, and I have this PhD in infant suck physiology and breastfed to kids. So sure, let's go learn about that.
This exactly how it happened is so funny. I was starting my practice from scratch, and she approached me along with her friend, a massage therapist that works with babies, and they told me some of the problem and what they were looking to do. And I'd used lasers before. I've done frenectomies and frenuloplasties before, but not on newborns, on older people, because the other reason you sometimes do these are for
Ooh,
dentures.
I didn't know that.
So I had, and then I had my PhD was all in the role of sensory information during infant suckling. So I had this background in that, having breastfed myself. And so I felt like I had all the pieces. I just kind of didn't know how to put all that together to help her out. So I started taking some classes and then got really inspired by that. And we started building this multidisciplinary clinic in my office. So yeah, my undergrad degree was in anatomy, like evolutionary anatomy. And then I did my PhD work was in biomedical sciences, but my dissertation was all about oral sensory information during suckling using an infant pig as a model to better understand infant humans. And then I did my dental degree. Those were both at University of Maryland. My research was at Hopkins. And then I did a residency program to do more advanced dental surgeries and dental work. And then I moved back home, which is Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and started this practice from scratch.
Yeah, so we went, the three of us, the body worker, myself, and Dr. Holman, to go train, to go to a conference, really specifically delve into this work with infants and look at it from a functional perspective. And then, because we all have that research inclination, even though this is very difficult research to publish, which we can get into, we have had such a curious mindset and have really thoughtfully and carefully evolved the way that we practice. And so when I wrote about tongue ties in the book, right, where I'm generalizing, Dr. Holman isn't everyone's surgeon. Not everyone is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So that's where it connects back to the New York Times for me, where I really had to sit in like, okay, if I don't have Dr. Holman in front of me, what is the recommendation I'm going to give to parents? And so this is where I think the New York Times got it wrong, was really looking at a few cases of probably malpractice or at least like not deeply thoughtful practice, which you'll find in any area of medicine. And then to look at the research, but not talk to those of us in the field that interpret the research, which is to say that it's very difficult to be like, I'm gonna mess with this baby and see if it stops eating and not mess with this one, right? Like that's what it would take to do a double blind. And that's not ethical. You're never gonna get IRB approval to do that ethical research. So it is really challenging to research. And so my recommendation has always been like, really look for functional assessment, really look for providers that you trust, and then really listen to those providers directly.
As someone who was struggling, and this was my son's 8 years old now, so 8 years ago, I feel like even since then, I've learned so much more about women's health. I feel like there's so much that's changing, and when you're in that struggle, what is it? And I think, just like with my fertility journey, when you're struggling, you'll do anything. And it's so hard to know who to trust, how to know what to do, et cetera. So I guess, Victoria, I don't know if maybe a good place to start, you're the expert here, but like, what is the baseline that we start with? Because at some point, tongue tie becomes a part of the conversation.
So, when a baby is born, there are very few things that human babies can and need to do when they're born. We have just like these very immature, kind of dumb babies, and we love them and take care of them with our big brains, our opposable thumbs, and our many tools. And so, one of the things that they need to do is eat. And in order to eat, it's actually pretty complicated. And this is where Doc's research in pigs is so interesting because pig suckling is so similar to human suckling. And just like we said, the ethics are complicated. So that does change with our current science model of doing an animal model versus a human model, right? So with a baby, they need to, in order to do a suck correctly, get their tongue all the way past the gums. While it's past the gums, cup, so curl up the edges, And then while it's curled up and over the gums, drop the back all the way down to make a vacuum. So babies don't, I would say, like, it's not like drinking out of a straw. It's like eating a taco, right? Babies nurse and ideally bottle feed with their whole mouth, using mostly movement at the back of the mouth. And the front of the mouth is actually just making that suction cup. And so you need a lot of that ability for the lip to flip and the tongue to curl and reach to make that shape. Babies are like, I'm going to eat. I'm going to survive. And parents are like, I'm going to feed this baby. So if they can't do that, what often happens is a lot of pain because they're using the wrong muscles. And so they're doing a chewing motion instead of that vacuum motion where they're dropping at the back of the tongue. Instead, they're going to be doing more of a chewing motion with the front. So some things that we're looking for initially are you in pain? Is baby gaining weight well? Are they, if you're doing bottles, are they able to do a bottle without coughing or sputtering or it taking an hour to do a bottle? If you're nursing, does your nipple come out looking flat or with a straight line across it? And then your first step is going to be talking to a feeding expert, a lactation consultant, to figure out, like, is this a positioning thing? Is this like, they don't know how to do it and we can sort of use tools to teach them? Or is there an actual structure that's causing an inability to do that? So everybody has a frenum under their tongue, which is the little piece of tissue that attaches your tongue to the floor of your mouth. And there are more of them throughout the body, including one right under your lip, right? For those on YouTube, right under your top lip, under your nose. And so if either of those is very tight, with collagen that doesn't stretch, which is genetic, it's going to potentially cause issues with function, either with eating properly, eating solid food properly, closing your lips while you're sleeping and at rest, or speech and those other issues that we talked about later down the road.
Just quick question. There's also a cheek tie too, right?
Oh, the cheek ties, yeah. I mean, with cheek ties, there's still a lot of controversy about those and if they impact babies with their latching. And if they do seem to appear to be impacting the baby latching, is it best to release them at the same time as everything else? Or do we do that like in a delayed manner? Functionally, though, later in life, buckle ties really don't lead to much of the other functional things Victoria mentioned about like speech and swallowing and chewing trouble. The other time as a dentist where I sometimes need to release buckle ties is for the fit of a denture. Because the denture needs to hold on by going up into that vestibule and it can't physically get there if the buccal frenums are very low on the sides. When a baby's nursing or when a baby has a tongue tie, it's very common that when they can't use their tongue very well, that their upper lip muscle gets really, really active. Like that upper lip is trying to create a seal that the tongue is not doing. Yeah, the tongue can't do it, so lip gets really involved. So we tend to see this upper lip completely curl under and dimple and just be really tight. But that's not always because the structure itself is tight. It's often because the tongue is tight. The tongue isn't doing what it's doing. And once we get the tongue tie released, this upper lip can flare out and relax and get out of the way. So I find that sometimes buccal frenums feel very prominent when I'm doing an exam on a baby. And then after a tongue tie release is done, or even that midline lip is done, I don't feel these anymore. They relax once that muscle is relaxed.
And I think that speaks to that like bigger function question, right? That we're looking at like tension in the neck, tension in a baby's body. And some of that can be from birth or pregnancy, right? We grow babies in a tiny bowl. They need some space and time to stretch out. But also this piece, I think about it like rock climbing, that like if you're up on the wall and you're like in your big muscles and your legs, your hands and your fingers aren't doing all that much, right? It's the same with a baby's lips should not actually have to be doing that much. They're mostly just making a seal. But if your tongue can't move correctly, then you're going to do something. So you're all what I call grip and grab. So they're going to be overusing that muscle. That muscle is going to get really big and overdeveloped. And then it's going to look like tension against the other muscles because of how that baby's eating. And so that's where I push back on the New York Times article, which didn't get into like, did they have an in-depth functional assessment? Like, when someone comes into our clinic, and this isn't available everywhere, there is a body worker that's actually doing hands-on massage therapy to release tension throughout the head and neck so that Dr. Holman can get a good visualization, but also so that we've ruled out that it's not, the issues aren't being caused by that kind of tightness. Then I'm watching a baby eat and I'm really looking at like, what muscles are they using? Are they correctly trying to use the right muscles? Do they have access to them, but they don't know how to use them? Like, what does that look like in terms of actual function? What does feeding look like throughout the day? Maybe this feeding in front of me is great, but they take usually 2 hours, right? Like, that's all information that I'm looking at. And then Dr. Holman does a very thorough physical exam where she's looking for those buckles. She's looking like, what are thick muscles? What is tension? Because I don't know all that much about the anatomy of the mouth, whereas Dr. Holman knows a whole lot about that.
I'll say another thing about buccal ties too, is that if the buccal ties need to be released, what I hear from my lactation and SLP colleagues is that when babies have the lip, tongue, and buccals released all at once, those babies tend to struggle a lot post-release, much more so compared to just doing lip and tongue or just tongue. So if I question the buccal frenems as being maybe they are kind of tight feeling, like I don't know that those are going to completely relax when everything else is done, I still will intentionally delay that release and say, let's do the lip and tongue first. We know that's going to improve things a lot. And if it still feels like there's just too much tension over here, let's give this a week or two. Then I can release that at a separate time once baby's kind of recovered from these two wounds.
So can we take a step back then? Because what I just want to make sure I'm not misinterpreting. So part of the controversy is that it seems as though there are cases where it may appear moms are being taken advantage, I should say families are being taken advantage of. I guess I'm just saying mom because she's doing the nursing, but families are being taken advantage of by having procedures done that are unnecessary. And what I want to clarify is originally when you were speaking, Victoria, about how, you know, there could be different stages in life where the tie can have an impact. I guess one thing I was wondering is, because of that potential, should everyone have it released so that you don't have the things down the line? But also there was the nuance of not everyone is going to be affected. And so I guess I'm now curious around this whole, like, does it need to be done in all cases? How do you know when?
Yeah, it is confusing. And that's why this isn't just like, it looks like this, these are the symptoms, this is the recommendation. And a lot of research studies and tools out there try to simplify this into like a formula with an answer, and it's just complicated. So sometimes when the three of us do our assessments on these babies and step out of the room to discuss, sometimes we look at each other and go, that's a tongue-tied baby. This is going to help. We're all on the same page. And then we come back and it's just really straightforward. And other times we're like, you know, it looks kind of tight. And Victoria says, you know, that might be part of the issue, but part of the issue might be this other thing. And then our massage therapist says, well, there's also some signs of torticollis that could also be playing a role here. And sometimes we have to really scratch our heads a little bit and talk to each other about where do we even start here. And if a tongue tie release is part of this puzzle, is it best to do it now? Is it best to do it even if it doesn't make an impact because I'm pretty confident it's going to lead to other problems later on? That's sometimes part of our conversation. Okay. And a lot of times we will come back to a parent and say, you know, this frenum looks tight and looks like this could be likely to lead to other problems. And we do recommend releasing it, but we don't know that a release is going to fix your current problem because of these other factors. So sometimes that is kind of our conversation. We've even had babies, including my own. My child number three was a situation where mom's not having any breastfeeding problems. Weight's good. Feedings are quick. No gas reflux. I mean, they're managing through. Usually that's because mom has a pretty darn good supply and baby's doing something like a suck and it's just not, there's no major flag or problem. But if the tongue frenum is really, really tight and right behind the tip of the tongue, and when I test reflexes, those reflexes are not showing me great range of movement. and maybe I can see some subtle other things which I can go into. Sometimes the recommendation still is like, look, this is such a minor procedure, and the chance of like this tongue tie that's almost to the tip of the tongue causing some kind of problem down the line is certainly high. And that's, again, not to say a parent has to do something right then. Some parents are a little bit more like you're saying, like, if this is going to cause a problem in the future and this is such an easy procedure to do now, I'd rather do it now. I have other parents that are like, you know, I'd rather take the watch and see approach, and let's see if we have a problem, we can address it then. So in those cases, I try to talk through what that would look like. You know, that might mean, let's see how solid foods go. But around six to eight months, if solid food introduction is not going well, and a speech therapist is now involved, and it's because the baby cannot move their tongue, we can still do a release pretty easily at that age. But I do try to talk through, like, you know, if the baby's already maybe not having any feeding problems, but the baby is snoring and sleeping with their mouth open, that starts to worry me about development of sleep apnea. Like, that's a thing that leads to bigger things that makes me a little, maybe push a parent more towards, I really think this would be a good thing to deal with now versus later.
You know, it's funny in reading this book and having this discussion with Victoria, before I started reading her book, I actually had interesting conversations with my childhood best friend, my own son, and my ex-husband, because we're looking back now at my son, who ended up having long-term health issues with constipation that, like, terrorized our family for I don't even know how many years. And it was so awful trying to talk to doctors who completely would do, he has sensory stuff, and they wanted us to do all these different things that were just breaking him. And so I agree with you, like, doing things late is so hard because you have all those added layers. And again, I'm not trying to scare parents, but that proactive thing is so important. But I asked my ex-husband, I was like, did we have anyone talk to us about body work? And my childhood friend was here a couple weekends ago, and she works at Boston Children's. She's a pediatrics infectious disease. And, you know, sometimes we agree to disagree on some of the things that experts bring up on the podcast. But I was so excited because she was like, why are you calling this a baby chiropractor? And I was like, well, actually, they're doing massage. She goes, that's such a terrible term, baby chiropractor, because I'm thinking twisting the neck and like all this stuff. I'm like, no, they're gentle. So when I explained to her what the massage therapists do with babies, she said, it's so interesting. When her daughters were little, she's Indian, her mother would, that's all she did with the babies. And her mom was like, you don't know this? Like, you guys don't do this in America? Like, this is the thing we do. And I look back and I don't know if that was ever presented to us, but my son had clear issues. Not a single person caught it. He ended up nursing till he was 14 months. And then I stopped, although I was just looking at old pictures and I forgot he didn't seem interested in nursing. So we just kind of just stopped, and I did wean him off, but I saw for like 3 months, he would have his hand down my shirt. And that's how, if I was holding him, that's all he would do. So I'm like, was he really done? Was I a bad mom? Did I stop too early? Because it seemed like neither one of us was interested. So, but it was so funny. I'm like, he always had his hand on my shirt if I was holding him.
I would argue that that's probably a bigger part of his sensory profile. If you're saying that, like, he has other sensory needs, that tactile piece
maybe
might have been important to him in a way that is different from the eating piece.
Yeah, maybe.
Might just been like a pretty neutral comfort thing. But I think the body work piece in that conversation you're having feeds back into this. So there are chiropractors who do this work. Chiropractic care on infants looks very different from adults. It's very slow, very gentle. It is about the amount of pressure you use pushing a piece of paper across a table. Very, very gentle. That being said, again, just like there is with dentists treating tongue ties or lactation consultants, a wide range of practice. So we very aggressively vet our referral list. When we give someone a referral, we say, you may be comfortable seeing a chiropractor or not. Here are some people in our area that we know and trust. Here are some pros and cons of the ways they practice because we know them. Here's a list of massage therapists that do similar work, albeit more slowly because of their different scope of practice. They may or may not be close to you. They may or may not be covered by insurance. Here's that information. And then we also in our area have one or two pediatric osteopaths, which are similar to MDs, but also do manual therapy. And so, and they're much more common in Canada. And actually that's like the one double blind I do have is there is a double blind trial of osteopathic hands-on manual therapies. Also PTs will do this manual therapy as well as functional therapy. And so in the study, it's osteopaths because it's a Canadian study, and they did pretend body work on half the babies and actual body work on half the babies that were having suck dysfunction is how they defined it. And it did make a statistically significant difference. So like there is, albeit a small evidence base for that, but that's about all we ever get in lactation anyway. And that's, again, this question of like the risk benefit, right? Like risk benefit changes over time. The risk of holding down a two-year-old to do this procedure that then means they fear the dentist,
right,
is a much greater risk, even though it's the exact same procedure. That's an added risk that we don't have with an infant, that like it's 30 seconds, it's 2 minutes away from their parent. There's a very low risk of bleeding with a qualified provider who is skilled with that tool, right? That looks different. There is still some risk. We have had a handful of babies that had trouble figuring out how to eat after that. It's pretty rare, but it happens. There are risks to everything that we do. And that's something I talk about in the book, is that you get to decide holistically in your household. Like if somebody is having just an absolutely horrible time and they're up all night and their baby takes so long to eat a bottle that they never, ever, ever get a break and their baby's miserable and they're miserable. And I'm like, it's a coin toss if this is going to help, like from our assessment. The benefit of ruling it out may be much higher for them than someone that's like, eh, he's a little gassy, but it's like not that big a deal. We might wait and see in that one. So I think that's one of the things I pride myself on is we really trust our parents to be collaborators with us. I always tell parents to look for curious providers. We're very curious about what we're doing. We do approach folks with like, these are the symptoms we're seeing. This is what concerns us. This is what doesn't concern us. These are the options. If it's a really clear cut, strong recommendation, which I would say in our case where our referral chain is pretty effective, is about half of our patients are really straightforward and about half are complicated. And that's not to say the tongue tie is not indicated, but in those more complicated cases, I mean, it's always a conversation of like, this is our recommendation. We'd love y'all to talk about it, learn about the procedure, decide what you want to do. But in those more complicated cases, we're really going to talk about like, here's how far we think body work might get you. Here's how far we think lactation might get you. Here's how much you should expect to have to do in terms of therapies afterwards. You know, like we feel great about the fact that your baby's mouth is closed when they're sleeping, or we feel worried that your baby's mouth is always open. We're concerned about the shape of the palate because of XYZ, or Dr. Holman might be like, you're not having a nursing issue, but that is going to cause a gap between teeth, which could cause cavities, so that parents get to do the risk benefit based on the way that they view risk, because you and your childhood best friend view risk of alternative medical care differently.
Yes.
And that's okay.
I will say one thing I tend to see a lot, because I see people through the ages, is I tend to hear a lot from parents that they were told or under the assumption that the tongue tie was only important if you were breastfeeding.
Ooh, that's a really good point.
And that they felt that they were selfish because they wanted breastfeed if they made that decision to do a tongue tie release. I hear all the time from the older kids.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
And they felt like nobody really explained that some of maybe the GI issues they ran into with bottles, or their kid is now in speech therapy or has a lot of issues eating solid foods and only like softer foods and no textures. Like they had no idea about that kind of stuff. And then to see how quickly some of that stuff turned around after a release in their older kid has them feeling not great about, you know, some of the other struggles they had before that, like feeling like they could have prevented some of that stuff
right,
too.
Now, one of the things they also talked about was the clipping versus the laser and how there's a push to do the expensive laser, but it's really not needed. Like So let's say the decision is it's time to do it. Tell us laser versus the traditional old-fashioned clipping.
As far as expense, I think that's going to really vary based on people's experience and their insurance coverage, because it might be, there's some medical insurances that only cover this procedure if a medical doctor does it. There's, if you have dental insurance, they're going to almost cover it in full, you know? So like it totally depends. And some dentists bill medical insurance. Like that's what we do here.
So is it insurance-based definition of the procedure? Like if I had my option and it wasn't insurance-based, which one is a better option?
I would think the medical procedure is going to be way more expensive, to be honest, just because medical billing codes would be higher than a dental. I don't know. But I don't know for sure. I don't know what everyone's fees
but
are
like tool to tool.
Yeah, tool to tool.
Yeah,
for
but just
me,
like fee-wise, yeah, that's...
Right, you're going in for knee surgery, and surgeon A uses like an old school knee replacement, blah, blah, blah. And surgeon B uses the bionic, blah, 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 blah. Right? If you have the means to go find the best of surgeon A and the best of surgeon B, you're probably going to end up with good results either way. If you live in an area where you have someone hot out of school that's done two of these, that's doing the fancy knee replacement, and somebody who's done 500 really effective of the old ones, I'm going to go with the old one, right? So this is another risk-benefit thing. If you have comparable providers that are very skilled with their tool, are trained to use that tool, have a nuanced approach to assessment, and a plan for aftercare, I'm happy. There is a practice of parents holding babies sometimes for the scissor release, which I don't care for, because there is more bleeding with the scissor. So in terms, so what I say like to everyone, because I'm not a dentist, I don't have a dog in that fight, is find the most skilled, reputable provider that you can access. This is a one-time thing. If it is possible for you to cover the cost, find the provider who's going to do the best job. Now, I'm going to pass to Dr. Holman to explain why she uses the tool she uses.
And also, say back to the thing about fees, I think that also people don't usually go to medical providers unless they're in their network and they take their insurance, and that's where that cost gets run down. I think the actual fee, if they were paying a medical doctor completely out of pocket, that fee's going to be higher. That's just not normally seen in the medical approach. No, I totally agree with Victoria saying I've seen some really great scissor releases. I've seen some really awful scissor releases, and same with laser. I think what makes this procedure hard as the dentist doing it is has much more to do with the diagnosis methods that the person is using. And then also there's the tool and the actual procedure. But I think where you see a very big difference between providers is how they are doing the assessment. I've spoken to many dentists and ENTs that just say, the lactation consultant told me there was a tongue tie, I released it. What's the big deal? They don't like not factoring anything else into the equation or really doing an assessment of reflexes or really thoroughly looking at making, like as the doctor, we are the ones that make the diagnosis. A lactation consultant cannot diagnose a tongue tie.
Unless they have another credential. So if they're a speech therapist and a lactation consultant or a nurse practitioner and a lactation consultant, they may be able to. Myself, that's my standalone credential. I do not diagnose tongue ties. I assess for function and I refer to Dr. Holman.
Okay.
Right. So if your release provider has no methods of doing a diagnosis, that would be a red flag.
Okay.
But do you feel like there is more precision with the laser than the scissors so that there's a theoretical lower risk?
There are a lot of things I do for a reason because I think I get a better result, and I can't speak to other people, of course. But a few things about that. First, I'm 7.5 time zoomed in for my eyes. So in my field of view is humongous down there. It's not so tiny. There are release providers that don't wear magnification when they do it. I also use a groove director, which is a tool that isolates the frenum very precisely and kind of pushes on either side so I can really get a good release that way. Again, there's other people that use a finger or don't use any tool to isolate it. So to me, that gives me a certain level of precision. And then there's also a bunch of different types of lasers. I mean, just because a dentist says they have a laser, that doesn't mean it's the same laser. So the laser I use is a CO2 laser. It comes out in pulses. In order to do any kind of release, I have to be pretty close and steady on a target for it to release. So if theoretically there was movement or something like that, like it wouldn't do anything. So like the combination for me of all those things and the fact that the laser is cauterizing, so I have no blood. I can see, I have a really clear visual field. I can see when I've released tension. I can feel it. Like all those things together are what works good in my hands.
Can you discuss the costs just so that like estimations?
I have patients that everything's covered 100% by their medical insurance or dental insurance and pay nothing. I have other parents that pay a small copay, like towards a procedure. So it really ranges. For people that have no insurance at all, we just have a flat rate fee that they pay that covers their follow-ups, any amount of releases that are needed, the exam, the lactation, the body work is just kind of a one lump sum fee. I think those fees range from maybe $600-$700 to maybe $1,500 in different states and practices. And again, not most providers don't practice with this team approach. So that could change that cost. But I think that's the ballpark you're looking in.
Okay. I think I know the answer, but I would like, let's pretend you're the committee, you know, the body worker, the IBCLC, the dentist with the PhD. and you're talking to the payers and you're like, here is the value add of covering team-based care for these babies. Like, what is the cost down the road if we don't look at this today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the business side is kind of similar to the doula arguments. I mean, you're just going to, if you're trying to save Medicaid money, you know, you're going to save Medicaid money if the baby's breastfeeding, because you're not going to have to pay as much towards the formula. Like, there's other more support. You're going to need speech and language pathology services, OT services, PT services, all these things we see these kids end up needing. That's where they can really save on that cost.
So for the parents, I would say there's two categories. Ones who are like, I can't afford this. So what is the minimum? Like baby massage? Is there a book? And then for the parents that do, I think you kind of alluded to already throughout the episode of things to look for, but maybe there's like one or two big things. So parents who can't afford, parents who can, maybe two buckets there on your top recommendations, the must-haves.
So a tie, like that actual structure under the tongue, it doesn't stretch. It's not going to change if we don't release it. So in that case, it would be talking to your insurance, talking to local providers, figuring out where you can get the best coverage that is accessible to you. Some providers, I think increasingly, are working really hard to make that happen. Then after that, in terms of the body tension piece, if you're not able to see a lactation consultant, though many folks who are lower income are able to see someone through WIC, increasingly lactation consultants do take insurance. Some are able to do online via insurance, again, because of increased Medicaid coverage, thanks to the work of one of our amazing local IBCLCs and editor of the Journal of Human Lactation, Ellen Chetwin, for her doctoral research, actually like drove that forward.
Okay.
Yeah. And then as the provider, you know, asking about payment arrangement options, care credit is a popular one that a lot of patients use to help pay for any dental expenses that are unforeseen. Care credit allows you to make interest-free payments over the course of whatever period of time, but that can keep payments down to $50 a month or something like that.
Awesome. It's great to see what you're doing. And now let's see if the payers can see the value as well. But I'm sure everyone got so much out of this episode, and thank you for your commitment to really digging into this with all of your patients.
Thank you so much for having us. We really love this work. And like I said, we're giant nerds, so we also really love talking about it and sharing about it.
Yes, thank you so much. And, you know, both of us are on Instagram and love engaging in discussions and giving our two cents on things. If you guys have questions, reach out.
And that wraps up another empowering session here at the FemPower Health Podcast. Now, before you dash off, I've got a quick, exciting invitation for you. Please join our vibrant community by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, because it's really your frontline update on groundbreaking women's health research, the latest health-enhancing products, fun quizzes to boost your health IQ, and unique discoveries that you won't want to miss. All of this delivered straight to your inbox, cutting through the noise of social media algorithms. Love today's insights? Show your support by rating and reviewing our podcast. Your feedback is more than just a pat on our backs here at FemPower Health. It lights the way for others seeking guidance and community in their health journey, amplifying the voices that need to be heard. And for a deeper dive into today's topics, check out the show notes and explore our website at fempower-health.com. Our site is a treasure trove of knowledge, neatly categorized by topics of interest and life stages, ensuring you find exactly what you need to empower your health journey. And your voice matters to us deeply. Whether you have a question, a story to share, or feedback on our episodes, reach out directly at info@fempower-health.com, drop us a message on social media, or hit reply on any newsletter. Your insights inspire our conversations. And a quick note, the knowledge we share is here to embolden you in discussions with your healthcare provider. It's not medical advice. Always consult with your doctor for health decisions. And remember, the diverse perspectives of our guests reflect their individual journeys, and it's not an endorsement by FemPower Health. Here's to empowering your health journey one episode at a time, and I'll see you on the next FemPower Health podcast episode.